Blog Talk Radio.
From the far reaches of the known universe, we are proud to present Brother Harold Muhammad, soldier, scientist, scholar. Blog Talk Radio's finest, not so mad science, on Black Hole Radio. Black Hole Radio. Black Hole Radio.
Assalamu alaikum, and welcome to tonight's edition of Not So Mad Science here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Once again, and as always, coming to you live from the city of Detroit with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad. Just because Berry Gordy took Motown to L.A. does not mean Detroit has lost its soul. Briefly, we are unprepared tonight. So, to that end, we're going to spend about 10 or 12 minutes on anxiety disorders because I am truly anxious at this time.
Distinguished future physicians, welcome to Stomp on Step 1, the only free video series that helps you study more efficiently by focusing on the highest yield material. I'm Brian McDaniel, and I will be your guide on this journey through anxiety disorders. This is the third video in my playlist covering psychiatry. And we're going to review things like generalized anxiety disorder, PTSD, phobias, and panic attacks. Anxiety is uncontrolled fear, nervousness, and or worry about trivial or non-existent things. It is an unpleasant fear of future events that are unlikely to occur. Some patients have insight and realize that their uneasiness is illogical, but that does not alleviate symptoms. A certain level of anxiety is considered normal in many situations, but frequent anxiety or anxiety that inhibits function is pathologic. During anxiety, sympathetic nervous system activation can result in physical symptoms such as palpitations, tachycardia, shortness of breath, muscle tension, restlessness, lack of focus, sweating or chills, and changes in sleeping patterns. In order to make a diagnosis of anxiety, one must rule out other potential causes of these symptoms. The differential diagnosis for anxiety includes other psychiatric disorders, cardiac abnormalities such as myocardial infarction or valvular disease, endocrine disorders like hypothyroidism, and respiratory disease such as asthma or pulmonary embolism. Substances such as street drugs and prescribed medications must also be ruled out as potential causes of these symptoms. We're going to hold off on discussing most of the different treatment options for anxiety until a later video that will cover all of the pharmacology for the psychiatry section. That video will cover things like SSRIs, anxiolytics, and cognitive behavioral therapy, which can be used to treat anxiety disorders. However, during the video, I will mention a couple of treatment options that are used for specific anxiety disorders. We will start our discussion with generalized anxiety disorder, or GAD. You can see here in the top right corner, I give GAD a high yield rating of 2. For those of you who aren't familiar with the high yield rating, it is a scale from 0 to 10 that gives you an estimate for how important each topic is for the USMLE Step 1 Medical Board exam. GAD is a prolonged period of near constant anxiety. Their anxiety is not linked to a specific item, person, or situation, so it isn't a phobia. They usually worry about a wide variety of things, including school or work performance, finances, health, friends, and/or family members. Their anxiety is generalized across many situations. Their anxiety frequently presents with physical symptoms and may be severe enough to impair function. A panic attack is a sudden onset period of extremely intense anxiety, accompanied by numerous signs and symptoms of anxiety. The attack is often associated with a sense of impending doom. These episodes usually last 10 to 30 minutes and are disabling. The patient returns to their normal level of function soon after the panic attack. They may be brought on by an inciting event or be completely unprovoked. I'd like to stop here for a moment to clarify the difference between generalized anxiety disorder and a panic attack. G- GAD can be thought of as a constant moderate level of anxiety, while panic attacks are short periods of severe anxiety. Panic disorder is recurrent panic attacks that are unprovoked and have no identifiable trigger. The onset of these anxiety episodes is unpredictable. Patients may be relatively asymptomatic between attacks, but often have anxiety about having more attacks. Their fear is related to the panic attacks themselves rather than a particular external stimuli. This differentiates panic disorder from panic attacks that are caused by things like phobias. Agoraphobia is anxiety related to open spaces and/or crowded places. These people are afraid of being helpless or embarrassed in a situation that is difficult to escape from. This often leads to avoidance of such experiences, and in severe cases, these people never leave their homes. Agoraphobia is most closely related to panic disorder. In this situation, patients fear having an unexpected panic attack in a place where they may be embarrassed in front of others or help may not be available. However, agoraphobia can be the result of other psychiatric disorders such as specific phobia. Specific phobia is an excessive amount of anxiety related to a specific situation or item that interferes with function. Common examples include fear of heights, spiders, or medical injections. These individuals can be relatively asymptomatic in the absence of exposure to what they fear. Some individuals will adapt quite well, and you won't even know they have a phobia because they are good at avoiding the exposure. For example, somebody afraid of heights may move to an area with no mountains or high-rise buildings. Specific phobia can lead to a panic attack. However, these attacks only occur as a result of exposure to what they fear. They will not have panic attack in the absence of external stimuli. This differentiates it from panic disorder, where the individual will have unprovoked panic attacks. In extreme cases, specific phobia can lead to agoraphobia. For example, if somebody is deathly afraid of spiders, they may never want to leave their house. Treatment can include exposure therapy. Here, the patient creates a hierarchy of fears and is exposed to them in order of increasing level of fear. So a person who is afraid of heights will start with standing on a step stool and then slowly work their way up to using an elevator and going to the top of a skyscraper. By taking baby steps, patients are often able to do things that they would never have been able to do without the process. In certain situations, benzos may be used if the feared stimuli is infrequent and unavoidable. For example, somebody who is afraid of flying but only takes a few flights a year may be well controlled with benzos on an as-needed basis. Social anxiety disorder, aka social phobia, is anxiety in social situations such as public speaking, eating in public, or using public restrooms. This usually includes an intense fear of scrutiny and judgment from others. These patients may be relatively asymptomatic if they can avoid being the center of attention. Sociophobia can be thought of as a specific phobia, where the fear is related to social situations. However, despite the similarities, the two disorders are separate diagnoses in the DSM. In extreme cases, social anxiety disorder can lead to panic attacks. Beta blockers are sometimes used on an as-needed basis for performance anxiety or stage fright. For example, if a person has to give a big presentation, you can give a beta blocker about 30 minutes before the meeting in order to block some of the sympathetic signals. They still have anxiety, but because the physical symptoms of anxiety are blunted, they won't realize they are anxious. Obsessive-compulsive disorder is anxiety and intrusive thoughts that drive the patient to unusual, repetitive actions called compulsions. The compulsions temporarily relieve the anxiety in some patients, while others feel like they just have to do their rituals. Common compulsions include counting their steps, repetitively washing hands, preoccupation with certain numbers, and rituals such as opening and closing doors repetitively. The patient often realizes that their fears and compulsions are irrational, but there remains a lack of control. OCD should not be confused with a similar-sounding obsessive-compulsive personality disorder, OCPD. There are some similarities between the two, as both can include a preoccupation with things like order, cleanliness, and organization. However, OCPD patients lack the classic compulsions found in OCD. OCD patients also have insight, while OCPD patients do not. In OCD, they view their thoughts and behaviors as abnormal, unwanted, and distressing. In OCPD, they view their way of thinking as normal and beneficial. They don't realize they have a disorder. We will discuss OCPD in much more detail in a later video covering personality disorders. If you'd like to skip ahead to that video, you can click on this orange box here. Post-traumatic stress disorder is anxiety related to a traumatic experience that may include flashbacks, nightmares, and avoidance of certain triggers that remind them of the experience. These patients may also have hyperarousal, where they have an amplified response to external stimuli such as loud noises. Classically, the trauma is experiencing or witnessing a life-threatening event or sexual assault. Symptoms must be present for more than a month in order to make a diagnosis of PTSD. If these same symptoms last for less than a month, the patient would be more correctly diagnosed with acute stress disorder. That brings us to the end of this video. If you found it helpful, please leave a comment below. Feedback from our viewers helps us improve Stomp on Step 1 and rank higher in search results. The next video in the psychiatry section is going to cover malingering, somatoform disorder, and factitious disorder. If you would like to be taken directly to that video, you can click on this black box here. Thank you so much for watching, and good luck with the rest of your studying.
Welcome back, welcome back. As I said, I'm feeling a little bit anxious right now. And because of that anxious feeling, I figured I'd share a little bit about anxiety disorders. Last week, if you recall, we discussed a little bit with respect to the weather. And how important it was to watch the weather. And I'm experiencing some feedback here, so we're going to try to eliminate it. Okay, that's a little bit better. Now, we have been talking a lot about the words of the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan in his historic one-year address last year, The Time and What Must Be Done, where he delivered a 2 to 3 hour discussion every, I believe it was Saturday, for an entire year. So we have 52 installments for the 52 weeks of the year. And prevalent in that discussion was the weather. Watch the weather. As we stated last week, we targeted the areas where the storm was going to come. And for those who wrote me and said, you know, the weather is very unpredictable. You know, you can predict things and don't happen. Well, let me share something with you. A string of violent storms that spawned possible tornadoes Friday of last week capped off a wild week of severe weather across the southern and eastern U.S. Mississippi Governor Phil Bryant declared a state of emergency this past Friday, last week, in response to the tornadoes that left behind a trail of destruction on Thursday of last week. Interestingly enough, this is the second time in less than a week that a state of emergency has been declared in Mississippi due to tornadoes. As of Friday afternoon last week, there were at least 5 fatalities associated with that storm. The latest fatality was from a traffic accident involving hydroplaning in Fort Gordon, Georgia. Earlier that Friday morning, go look outside, see this. Earlier that Friday morning, the storm caused the death of an 8-year-old girl in Leon County, Florida. The Leon County Sheriff's Office reported that a tree fell into a house in Woodville, located south of Tallahassee, killing the girl and injuring a 12-year-old boy. Three deaths occurred on Thursday of last week, one in Alabama and 2 in Mississippi. A 42-year-old woman was killed Thursday night last week in St. Clair County, Alabama. Monica Clements, may God be pleased with her, died when a tree fell on her home. According to the St. Clair County Sheriff's Office, as he spoke to the local news, WRBC, in St. Clair County. According to officials, Ms. Clements' 10-year-old son was also home at the time of the incident. He sustained minor injuries. In Mississippi, Amite County Coroner Campbell Sharp told the local news, WLBT, that 24-year-old Kendrick McGee was killed while driving in severe weather. McGee's car crashed on Bean Road in the Gillsburg community. He died as a result of his injuries. A tree fell onto a vehicle Thursday afternoon last week in Neshoba County, Mississippi, leaving one person dead, according to the Neshoba Democrat News. There have been widespread power outages as a result of the storm blast as it moved eastward. Over 200,000 electric customers were without power last Friday evening from Mississippi to Florida and northward through Virginia, according to Power Outage USA. North Carolina topped the list with over 70,000 customers without power. These numbers, though, began to decline on Friday because they started to do quick work. Travel delays mounted as fallen trees and flooding made roads impassable. Atlanta's Hartsfield-Jackson International Airport had over 1,000 delays on Friday of last week. And airline delays and cancellations will continue to have ripple effects for travelers across the nation. Flash floods, severe thunderstorms, and tornado warnings clashed in regions of Mississippi and Louisiana on Thursday afternoon as a line of vigorous thunderstorms swept through the region. One tornado just missed striking Jackson, Mississippi, but instead passed through the nearby town of Clinton. Cars lay scattered across the Walmart parking lot there, knocked over onto their sides while rain continued to fall. In Utica, Mississippi, authorities reported a Hinds County school bus trapped by two trees on the road. Officials confirmed that the driver and the children were okay. Homes have been destroyed in Morton, Mississippi, after severe storms and a potential tornado moved through the area. Don't they wish it was a tomato? Storms ravaged Mississippi, Alabama, and the Florida Panhandle before moving into western Georgia on Thursday night. Having seen the destruction that played out in Mississippi, in the Mississippi Valley, over the past few days, are you ready now to heed the warning of watch the weather? Watch the weather. Did you know that a rare phenomenon occurred on Wednesday of last week as two tornadoes appearing near each other at the same time? They touched down just 4 miles west-northwest of Chautauqua, Oklahoma. Watch the weather. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. I'm anxious. Do you not believe that these storms will cause a plethora of anxiety disorders, agoraphobia, the fear of going outside? Watch the weather. As we prepare for our next installment, let's take a little listen to Daniel Beatty as he begins to tell you who's at the door. Knock, knock.
As a boy, I shared a game with my father. Played it every morning till I was 3. He would knock on my door and I'd pretend to be asleep till he got right next to the bed. Then I would get up and jump into his arms. Good morning, Papa. And my Papa, he would tell me that he loved me. We shared a game, knock, knock. Until that day when the knock never came. And my mama takes me on a ride past cornfields on this never-ending highway till we reach a place of high, rusty gates. A confused little boy, I enter the building carried in my mama's arms. Knock, knock. We reach a room of windows and brown faces. Behind one of the windows sits my father. I jump out of my mama's arms and run joyously towards my papa's, only to be confronted by this window. I knock, knock, trying to break through the glass, trying to get to my father. I knock, knock as my mama pulls me away before my papa even says a word. And for years he has never said a word. And so 25 years later I write these words for the little boy in me who still awaits his papa's knock. Papa, come home because I miss you. Miss you waking me up in the morning and telling me you love me. Papa, come home, because there's things I don't know, and I thought maybe you could teach me how to shave, how to dribble a ball, how to talk to a lady, how to walk like a man. Papa, come home, because I decided a while back I want to be just like you, but I'm forgetting who you are. And 25 years later, a little boy cries, and so I write these words and try to heal and try to father myself, and I dream up a father who says the words my father did not, dear son. I'm sorry I never came home. For every lesson I fail to teach, hear these words. Shave in one direction with strong, deliberate strokes to avoid irritation. Dribble the page with the brilliance of your ballpoint pen. Walk like a god, and your goddess will come to you. No longer will I be there to knock on your door, so you must learn to knock for yourself. Knock, knock down doors of racism and poverty that I could not. Knock, knock on doors of opportunity for the lost brilliance of the black men who crowd these cells. Knock, knock with diligence for the sake of your children. Knock, knock for me, for as long as you are free, these prison gates cannot contain my spirit. The best of me still lives in you. Knock, knock with the knowledge that you are my son, but you are not my choices. Yes, we are our father's sons and daughters, but we are not their choices. For despite their absences, we are still here, still alive, still breathing, with the power to change this world, one little boy and girl at a time. Knock, knock, who's there? We are!
Welcome back, welcome back. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. Throughout the eons of time, there have been many a mythos, a myth, many a story told that the earth itself is alive. Just recently, Ferris Jabba wrote an article in the an opinion piece, actually, in the New York Times, where he said that the earth is just as alive as you are. Scientists used to ridicule the idea. Not anymore. Every year, nearly 400 billion trees in the Amazon rainforest and all the creatures that depend on them are drenched in 7 feet of rain. 4 times the annual rainfall in London, 3 times the annual rainfall in New York City. This deluge is partly due to geographical serendipity. Now, for those of you who do not know, serendipity, what does it mean? What is it? Well, let's take a look. Serendipity. You hear that word quite a bit used, particularly by scientists. Well, in this instance, serendipity means the occurrence and development of events by chance in a happy or beneficial way. Well, we're looking at geographical serendipity. Intense equatorial sunlight speeds the evaporation of water from sea and land to sky. Trade winds bring moisture from the ocean, and bordering mountains force incoming air to rise, cool, and condense. Rainforests happen where it happens to rain quite a bit. But that's only half the story. Life in the Amazon does not simply receive rain. It summons it, beckons it, calls it, wills it to itself. All of that lush vegetation releases 20 billion tons of water vapor into the sky every day. Trees saturate the air with gaseous compounds and salts. Fungi, fungus, exhale plumes of spores. The wind sweeps bacteria, pollen, leaf fragments, and bits of insect shells into the atmosphere. The wet breath of the forest peppered with microbes and organic residues creates ideal conditions for rain. With so much water in the air and so many minute particles on which the water can condense, rain clouds quickly form. The Amazon forest sustains much more than itself, however. Forests are vital pumps of the Earth's circulatory system. All the water that gushes upwards from the Amazon forms an enormous flying river, which brings precipitation to farms and cities throughout South America. Some scientists have concluded that through long-range atmospheric ripples, the effect that affects the Amazon, it contributes to rainfall in places as far away as Canada. The Amazon's rain ritual is just one of the many astonishing ways in which living creatures transform their environments and the planet as a whole. Can we say the butterfly effect? Much of this ecology has only recently been discovered or at the least understood. We now have compelling evidence that microbes are involved in numerous geological processes. Some scientists think they play a role in forming the continents. Trees, algae, and other photosynthetic organisms produce most of the world's breathable oxygen, helping maintain it at a level high enough to support complex life, but not so high that Earth would erupt in flames at the slightest spark. Ocean plankton drives chemical cycles on which all other life depends and emits gases that increase cloud cover, altering global climate. Seaweed, coral reefs, and shellfish store amounts of carbon that balance the ocean's chemistry and defend shorelines from severe weather. And animals as diverse as elephants, prairie dogs, and termites continually reconstruct the planet's crust, altering the flow of water, air, and nutrients, and improving the prospects of millions of species. Human beings created man are the most extreme example of a creature transforming the earth. But they do not. Created man does not get the serendipity applause here. By spewing greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, created man has drastically altered the planet's response to solar radiation, spiking global temperatures, raising sea levels, and intensifying storms. One of the many obstacles to reckoning with global warming is the stubborn notion that human beings are not powerful enough to affect the entire planet. I don't believe it, to quote current President Donald Trump in his response to one of his administration's reports on anthropogenic climate change. And for those of you who do not know, anthropogenic meaning man-generated, man-caused climate change. In truth, we are far from the only creatures with such power, nor are we the first species to devastate the global ecosystem. The history of life on Earth in these last 6,000 years is the history of life remaking Earth. Faced with this preponderance of evidence, it is time to receive an idea that once was roundly mocked: the Gaia hypothesis, conceived by British chemist James Lovelock in the early 1970s and later developed with the American biologist Lynn Margulis. The Gaia hypothesis proposes that all the living and non-living elements of Earth are parts and partners of a vast being who in her entirety has the power to maintain our planet as a fit and comfortable habitat for life. Although this bold idea found an enthusiastic audience among the general public, many scientists criticized and ridiculed it. Personally, I would prefer that the Gaia hypothesis be restricted to its natural habitat, a station bookstall, rather than polluting works of serious scholarship, according to evolutionary biologist Graham Bell, who wrote these words in 1987. The microbiologist John Postgate was especially vehement. He said, "Gaia, the great Earth mother, the planetary organism," he wrote in New Scientist magazine, "am I the only biologist to suffer a nasty twitch, a feeling of unreality when the media invite me yet again to take it seriously?" Now, me personally, your lowly brother, Harold Muhammad, says this: the Earth yet is a planetary organism. It is constructed to serve its master and or host. This organism is cultivated in truth and is set to maintain a specific balance, which is not static, as the balance shifts to accommodate the numbers in which it is born to serve. Is the Earth itself a god, the great mother? It is the mother in the form that it gives forth its fruit, as we cultivate her to bear that fruit. Be it trees, grass, food stuff, and other items. It is a living system, but it is not independent. It is ruled by the planetary body at the center of the system in which the Earth is. It bends its will to the sun. Thus she travels at 1,037 and a third miles per hour, that great speed, around the Earth every day, like clockwork. We keep time by it. However, over time, some scientific opposition to the Gaia hypothesis waned. In his early writings, Dr. Lovelock occasionally granted Gaia too much agency, which encouraged the misperception that the living Earth was yearning for some optimal state. But the essence of his hypothesis, the idea that life transforms and in many cases regulates the planet, proved prescient and profoundly true. We and all living creatures are not just inhabitants of the earth, we are the earth. How do we know this is true? In scripture, we are told, from the earth we come, to the earth we return. Personally, I think it's time we revisit the Gaia hypothesis in a better understanding in life. Astrophysicist Dr. Adam Frank says we should relook at this Gaia hypothesis. Other scientists even agree that the planet is in a very meaningful sense alive. Yes, it is. If she were not alive, could she bring forth fruit? Could she bring forth food? The corn you eat, the peas you eat, the grass that the cows eat to give milk. Could she bring forth food that is ingested because it is alive, that give us sustenance, and the other animals that give them sustenance? And at their time, they are returned back to the earth from whence their food came. From the earth we come, to the earth we all must return. We must accept the fact that life is not something that happened on earth, but something that happened before and to the earth. To quote astrobiologist David Grinspoon, he says life is not something that happened on Earth, but that life is something that happened to the Earth. He agrees with me. There is this feedback between the living and non-living parts of the planet that make the planet very different from what it would otherwise be, according to Dr. Margolis. Earth, in the biological sense, has a body sustained by complex physiological processes. Life is a planetary level phenomenon, and the Earth's surface has been alive for a very long time. Not billions, but trillions of years. Those who bristle at the notion of a living planet will argue that the Earth cannot be alive because it does not eat, reproduce, or evolve. Does it not? Or is the adduction and the subduction of tectonic plates, the earthquakes and the volcanic activity ever changing the face of the planet over millennia? The Earth weighs 6 sextillion tons, and she maintains her balance of 6 sextillion tons, a unit followed by 21 ciphers. She never takes on more than she needs, and she does not give away more than she wants. Her weight is constant. She is never found weighing other than herself. At her core, she transforms energy. She moves. In her movement, she maintains a balance so that we are not thrown off by the centripetal motion of the spin of the Earth, that we are forever contained within her atmosphere due to the magnetism of her movement. Like many living creatures, the Earth is a highly organized structure, a membrane with daily rhythms. It consumes, storms, and transforms energy. And if asteroid hitchhiking microbes or spacefaring humans colonize other worlds, who is to say that planets are not capable of procreation? The Earth does, in fact, breathe. The Earth does, in fact, sweat. And many of us suffer as she quakes. If it birthed zillions of organisms that ceaselessly devour, transfigure, and replenish its air, water, and rock, and if those creatures and their physical environments evolve in tandem, then why should we think our planet, why shouldn't we not think of our planet as alive? Man, humans are the brains, the consciousness of the planet. We are of the earth. Thus, the earth is made aware of itself as we are aware of who we are. Look at it this way. Our ecological responsibility could not be clearer. By spewing billions of tons of greenhouse gases, we have not simply changed the climate, we have critically wounded a global life form and severely disrupted its biological rhythms. No other aspect of the living family has assembled as many privileges and aspects as we have from one perspective. No one else can see the sinews and the vessels of our planetary body as we do. Only we can help choose to keep the earth alive. If you want to get away from the metaphysical and mythological interpretations of the name, the Gaia hypothesis, the Earth's legacy can help us fulfill this responsibility. We can learn to recognize and amplify our planet's innate climate stabilizing processes. The Earth has its own methods for storing carbon, a complex chain of chemical reactions involving plants, plankton, and shellfish can lock atmospheric carbon in limestone. In addition to reducing carbon emissions, many Earth system scientists think we should study how to augment this natural sequestration and related processes. In recent years, the Amazon rainforest has endured unusually intense and frequent droughts, which some scientists have linked to deforestation and forest fires. Do you think the fires in California and the Santa Ana wind blows are accidental? Forest fires are a natural part of the process. Nature brings it about on its own with the spark of lightning. And then the winds blow. But every farmer knows sometimes you gotta scorch the earth and turn it over to bring forth stronger, greater, and newer life. it would be easy to compartmentalize these ecological shifts as local tragedies, but that detachment is an illusion. God is not mocked. So, seen through the lens of the earth itself, the Amazon's plight is the draining of our communal veins and arteries. We must learn to feel its thirst viscerally. We are part of this planet, and we therefore must consider our affairs not in isolation. We are so tied to the earth that it chills or fevers, or our chills and our fevers also. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We're going to hear a little time from Earth, Wind, and Fire. Reasons. We'll be right back. Welcome back, welcome back. This is Dr. Matt Stein with your host for the Harold Muhammad's here on the Black Hole Radio Network. While we get prepared for our next segment, which I think will make you laugh quite a bit, we're going to hear a little something about fear.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity, Katar. Now do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people won't feel insecure around you. We were all meant to shine as children do. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same, as we are liberated from our own fear. Our presence automatically liberates others.
So deciding as you look at your life, as you look into the future and say, what fears am I holding on to? What fears that I'm allowing to imprison me? That's keeping me from breaking out. That's keeping me from living up to my true potential. That's keeping me from really being happy. That's keeping me from having a sense of adventure and excitement in my life. What's keeping me from controlling my destiny? What fears that I'm giving that permission to? Notice what I said. We must give our permission to fear to immobilize us. Because whatever discomfort you experience, whatever challenges or difficulty that it is, you got to handle. Got to go up in there and wrestle with it. Will it be easy? No. Will it be challenging? Yes. But that's just what you must go through in order to get where you want to go. And guess what? You are strong enough to do it. You're strong enough, and your life is worth whatever you have to go through. You can either live your dreams or live your fears. And I think the majority of people actually are not living their dreams, but are living their fears. So I want to ask you a question. What are your fears? What are your fears? What are your fears? Because we all have fears. We all have something that's blocking us, that's holding us back. And as we begin to look at life, what we realize is that the reason that most people are not living out their true potential, not doing all of the things that they would really like to do, is because of fear. Some people call fear false evidence for expectations of feeling real.
Everyone is frightened of something. Maybe the fear of death, fear of loneliness, fear of not being loved, fear of not becoming famous, successful. Or also fear of not having physical security. There are so many multiple forms of fears. Not to go into this problem really very deeply. Can the mind, and in which includes the brain, be really fundamentally be free of fear.
You've been wrestling in your sleep. Have you ever woke up and your bed was wet? The bed is all torn, just like you've been in a fight, because your mind has not rested. Your body went to sleep, but your mind is still caught up in a warfare. Your mind is the battleground. Touch somebody and tell them the enemy's after your mind.
What, how we live our lives, our gifts are. What kind of gift are you giving? And what kind of gift could you give if fear wasn't an issue? I'm saying, you can have fear, don't surrender. Don't let your fears have you. You're more than capable of making this your decade.
Differential of somebody winning and losing has nothing to do with their genetics, has nothing to do with their potential. It's their perseverance, always showing up. A person that's willing to gamble. If you show up, then you have a chance. If you don't show up, the outcome's simple. Never there, like an audition. If you show up to the audition, there's a chance you might get the part. If you're too scared to show up, then you sit back at home, wondering what if and everything else. No one in hell is going to call you an opportunity because you weren't present. The winners always show up. They're willing to lose in order to gain. Big mental thing there, guys. This body, as great as you are, as sharp as you make the arsenal, it can't do anything if you don't have confidence in yourself. We all fall down in life. The question is, who gets back up? You go after and you give it all you have. If you lose, at least you try, man. I failed. It's 10 times more of a man than someone said, what if? Because what if never went to the arena? When you guys find a fear, that fear will either create you or destroy you. I love fear. The reason why? Behind every fear is a person you want to be. Fear is self-imposed, meaning it doesn't exist. You create it, you can destroy it too. It's an intangible. If you face your fears, guys, you will realize it's not that big. And once you face it, you go, oh my God, man, I spent all this time running from it. It was so small. If I just faced it, my God, not only did I face it, I beat it back. Energy's never lost, transferred. That negative energy, that fear, is destroyed. It comes back in as confidence. Like, what else am I capable of? What else am I holding my back from that I'm capable of more? What am I running from when I don't need to? What else can I overcome? You face your fears, you become the person you want to be. You run from your fears, you're not living. You're alive, but you're not digging in. The freedom, you're not running the day. The day's running you. You always be the fucking servant, not the master, guys. You find the fear, quick, the easiest way you can be it. Right when it comes in, if you allow it to sit, it will grow roots and start breaking you down, destroying the potential of the person you can be. Again, the champions, guys, it's not their potential, it's not their genetics, it's their perseverance to always show up, always willing to fail, because failure, that's part of success. Success is not, you know, a marathon of life, it's just ups. Success is formulated through failures, through facing your fears, through falling down and getting back up. That's what creates the champion. Success does not define us. We define the success.
Let me tell you something you already know. The world ain't all sunshine and rainbows. It's a very mean and nasty place, and I don't care how tough you are, it will beat you to your knees and keep you there permanently if you let it. You, me, or nobody is going to hit as hard as life. But it ain't about how hard you hit. It's about how hard you can get hit and keep moving forward. How much you can take and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done. Now, if you know what you're worth, then go out and get what you're worth. But you got to be willing to take the hits and not pointing fingers saying you ain't where you want to be because of him or her or anybody. Cowards do that, and that ain't you. You're better than that.
Welcome back, welcome back. Fear. False evidence. Appearing real. We have no right to be afraid of anything. Therefore, we are born into existence. Never to be victims of what we fear when we believe in a true and living God. Let's time warp back about 20 minutes. And we recall our discussion on the earth being alive. And let's make some associations between a few things. Whereas the oceans and rivers and streams are the arteries of the earth. And what happens in your body when you have a clogged artery? Well, take a gander at this one. Adam Clark Estes, just recently in Gizmodo online magazine, wrote, "A concrete berg, as opposed to an iceberg, a concrete berg as long as a football field has clogged London's sewers." So let's play a game called Good Idea, Bad Idea. What's a good idea? Flushing only biodegradable material down the toilet. Bad idea. Pouring a metric ton of concrete down a drain into a Victorian era sewer system. The city of London, England, is currently, oh boy, dealing with the consequences of someone's very bad idea. I would consider this to be tantamount to destroying the arterial pathways by which the body removes unwanted material from itself. A city's arteries, taking fresh water in through viaducts, and getting rid of bad water through the sewer systems. What happens when you clog that arterial pathway up? You get sick, just as you would in your body. Clogged artery, blood can't get back to the heart or get out of the heart. Guess what? You get very, very ill. To such a point where arterial sclerosis, clogged arteries, you then end up having to have heart surgery as a result of your clogged arteries, or your arteries have collapsed. Clogging the sewer system is equal to the function of the body of the city. Thus, the city of London is dealing with the consequences of someone's very bad idea. Thames Water, the city's public water utility, reported that it is removing a mass of solidified concrete that's over 300 yards long and weighs as much as a blue whale. Thames Water also says that the concrete berg is the biggest solid mass of its kind the company has ever seen, which is saying something for the city of London, which is famous for its enormous fat bergs that typically clog up the system. Normally, Blockages are caused by fat, oil, and wet wipes building up in the sewer. But unfortunately, in this case, it's rock hard concrete. It's in there and it's set, stuck to the Victorian brickwork that forms the old sewer system. So they need to chip away at it to get it removed. The concrete berg is blocking three sewers, and Thames Water expects to spend several hundred thousand pounds to clean up the mess. It will require up to 2 months of road closures and noise as workers use jackhammers and high-pressure hoses to break up the mass. This would be akin to an angioplasty in your arteries to break up the clog. Put a balloon in, blow the balloon up, it crushes, and you can move the stuff one out the way. Or go in and use an implement to scrape away the clog in your arteries. Only this time the implement is a jackhammer and a high-pressure water hose. Authorities believe that the mess was caused by some construction company dusting an industrial amount of concrete down a drain, which, as we've already pointed out, was a very bad idea. The situation does bring to mind London's ongoing struggle with the various types of bergs in its aging water system. As Mr. Saunders pointed out earlier, many of these are massive globs of fat and wet wipes that accumulate when people flush things down the toilet that should not be flushed. A couple of years ago, it was in Life magazine, it was reported that Thames Water found an enormous fat berg in a 4-foot-tall sewer that stretched 820 feet long and weighed an estimated 130 metric tons. That's a lot of dang fat. That one was 10 times the size of the famous bust-sized fatberg found in London's Kingston Borough back in 2013. All of the fatbergs are very expensive to remove and unspeakably disgusting to look at and exceptionally foul in smell. Concrete bergs are arguably worse, at least in terms of how you plan on removing it. Mr. Saunders said that this is not the first time some idiot has poured wet concrete into the sewers, although it's definitely the worst case. The Thames Water Company has launched an investigation into the situation, which again began with a very, very bad idea. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. So thanking God for this great and wonderful weather that we have at the present time, we're going to have a little Isley Brothers and Summer Breeze.
In my mind. in my mind.
Summer breeze makes me feel fine.
Blowing through the jasmine in my mind.
Makes me feel fine, blowing through the jazz.
Welcome back, welcome back. This is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. As we reflect back once again on the living Earth hypothesis, and one of those systems that are alive and a part of the living Earth concept and idea, back in February of this year, IFL Science magazine reported the world's insects are on the verge of a catastrophic collapse. The world's insects are heading towards a catastrophic collapse. And if the insects go, it's bad news for the rest of us. The worldwide decline of insects has been detailed in a major new meta-analysis published in the Journal of Biological Conservation that has reviewed 73 historical long-term reports of insect declines from across the globe, much of which happened to be carried out on populations in Europe and the U.S. They concluded that up to 40% of the world's insect species could face extinction within the coming decade. This is especially jarring when you consider their essential role in the wider ecosystems as pollinators, removers and or consumers of biodegradable material, decaying flesh and other things that are at work. If insect species losses cannot be halted, this will have a catastrophic consequence for both the planet's ecosystems and the survival of the made man, according to a study by Francisco Sanchez Bayo at the University of Sydney in Australia, who first reported on the study with a 2.5% rate of annual loss of insects over the last 25 to 30 years. In 10 years, you will have a quarter less. In 50 years, only half less. And in 100 years, none left. The root cause of the problem is the intensification of agriculture over the past six decades, in which genetically modified organisms are the rule and not naturally grown organisms. In turn, this leads to the worsening of other factors such as pollution, the destruction of habitat, and increasingly relentless uses of synthetic pesticides. Once again, it appears that food production is the main culprit of the problem. As such, the researchers urge for a global rethinking of current agricultural processes and practices, especially when it comes to the use of pesticides and genetically modified food. The conclusion is clear. Unless we change our way of producing food, insects as a whole will go down the path of extinction in a few decades. Climate change also stood as a major driver of this extinction in almost 7% of the studies. The report notes how increasing global temperatures have already reduced the range of dragonflies, stoneflies, and bumblebees. As global temperatures continue to creep up, the problem is only likely to affect more and more species, especially those living in tropical regions. It's not so much so that the temperatures are going up. It is the dramatic rate at which the temperatures are going up. Whereas we have discussed many times and gave evidence to on this show that the Earth once occupied a different orbit around the sun. Its day was 35 hours long in relation to its size of nearly 35,000 miles. In that orbit around the sun, the entire Earth was tropical. It maintained a relative temperature above 70, but below 90 degrees constantly, year-round. There were no seasons. It is its fall from its previous orbit to where it is now that we have these seasons. The dramatic change in seasons, animal life eventually began to, as well as insect life, adapted to. It is now this dramatic change without room for adaptation that insect life is now suffering as a result of the made man's abuse. We must look at our behavior. The report concluded that up to 40% of the world insect species could face extinction in the coming decades. Can we continue to ignore our abuse? Climate change. The report notes how increasing global temperatures have already reduced the range of certain insects. Soon, it will reduce the range of the made man. All these findings are particularly worrying because insects play a cornerstone role in the ecosystem of a living planet. Butterflies and moths, which play a vital role in pollination and natural pest control, are among the worst affected of all. Researchers note that out of 733 species of day-flying moths, up to 85% experience significant declines since 1980. Other vulnerable insects include numerous species of beetles and Hymenoptera, the order that contains wasps, bees, and ants. The global status of the world's Hymenoptera is not crystal clear, however. Numerous studies in Europe and in the U.S. have pointed to declines in certain populations of managed colonies of honeybees and wild bees, which carry out over 20% of the agricultural pollination. As insects comprise about two-thirds of all terrestrial species on Earth. The above trends confirm that the sixth major extinction event is profoundly impacting life forms on our planet. And this is Not So Mad Science with your host, Brother Harold Muhammad, here on the Black Hole Radio Network. We have now come to close of the 8 o'clock hour here on the Eastern Seaboard, which brings us to the close of our time together tonight. Allah willing, we will be together next week. And prayerfully, I hope and pray, as always, that someone decides to offer a question and or a comment. This is not a show to just say, hey, Brother Harold said, but to say, hey, Brother Harold questioned, and we all look for an answer. To that end, as I close out this edition of Not So Mad Science here on the Black Hole Radio Network, once again and as always, I leave you with the words of that immortal great warning politician, pastor of the Abyssinian Baptist Church in New York, the late Adam Clayton Powell Jr., the greatest black politician ever. Keep the faith, baby. Keep the faith.